episode 601, for November 19th, 2019. A Thousand Tongues of Silver, by Kate Hartfield. Rated PG-13. Welcome to Podcastle. I'm your host, Setsu Uzume. This week's story, A Thousand Tongues of Silver, was previously published in Lackington's in May 2018. It was written for you by Kate Hartfield. Kate Hartfield's fiction has been shortlisted for the Nebula, Locus, Aurora, Sunburst, and Crawford Awards. She is the author of the historical fantasy novel Armed in Her Fashion and the two Alice Payne time travel novellas. She also writes interactive fiction, including The Road to Canterbury for Choice of Games. Her forthcoming publications include a historical fantasy novel called The Humors of Grub Street, and another game, this one called The Magician's Workshop. Her work has appeared in Podcastle twice before, the stories Traveler Take Me and The Wedding of Snow, Earth, and Salt. A former journalist, Kate now lives in Ottawa, Canada. This week's story will be read for you by Allison Grauer. Allison Grauer is a writer, actor, podcaster, and tabletop gamer. She studied theater and history at Loyola University of Chicago. Together, she and her husband have formed the duo Whimsy and Artifice, which produces the ongoing project Warda. For more information, see welcometowarda.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher app. Her writing has been published in the Parsec Award-winning podcast anthology Tales from the Archives for the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, as well as in anthologies from Schuyler Publishing. Her first novel, On the Isle of Sound and Wonder, was published in 2014. Currently, she and her husband Drew are based out of Orlando, Florida, where they live with their two cats, Queen Felicia and Wedge. Follow Allison at DreamsToBecome on Twitter and Instagram. And now, grab the oldest book you can find, hold it in your hands, and enjoy the story.
A Thousand Tongues of Silver. Written by Kate Hartfield. Narrated by Allison Grauer. I am a book. My pages are purple. This is how they made me. First, they flayed the calves, stretched and scraped their wet skins. Then they mixed lichen and leaves, rotted in human urine, to mimic the purple that comes of torturing sea snails to force the desperate spew of sedative. Soaked my pages in all that stink until they turned the color of violence. Then I was ready to receive the quill. Letters of suspended silver ink with plenty of copper to prevent tarnish. Why silver, you may ask? Well, look at how beautifully it shines against the purple. Isn't that reason enough? It was reason enough for Amalasuintha. She didn't question it. Do you see the letter Yer? That is the letter the scribes call Year. It means the number 60, sometimes. It also means year. The year of my conception was 534 by some reckonings. Let's go there, to the city of Ravenna on the northern coast of the Adriatic Sea. A woman of perhaps 40 years old rules all of Italy and much of the rest of Europe, too, her father's kingdom. But her father, Theodoric the Great, king of the Ostrogoths, is long dead. And when her father died, she was herself already a widow, and her son was a mere child. So, Amalasuintha rules in her son's name, but no one has any illusions, least of all the man who was brought to Amalasuintha in chains. Theodahad, she says, cousin. She is wearing a stola of purple silk gathered at the shoulders with two magnificent eagle brooches that leave most of her shoulders bare. At her ears, two more eagles dangle, silver inlaid with precious gems in all the colors of the world. He is wearing fetters. "Cousin," he echoes, "is it really necessary to bring me here in iron? Was it really necessary for you to overrun all your neighbor's land? Every farmer in Tuscany has come to me to complain about you in the last few months, Theodahad. I don't have time for this. You're stealing their land." He shrugs. "If they can't see fit to protect it, you're better than this." He isn't. He knows he isn't. Theodahad has always been the problem in the family, the product of her aunt's youthful dalliance, Italian-born and bred, but never quite accepted anywhere. He's a decade older than Amalasuintha, and when he lets his long hair fall in front of his face to hide his snarl, it's streaked with silver. Then he tosses it back. "We always have to be better than everyone, don't we, cousin? Better than the Romans, because we're Goths. Better than the Goths, because we've taken the Roman throne." "We? You've taken nothing, except for some hills and some goats." His face moves like an earthquake. "How is your son, cousin?" he asks. "How is the king? He will be old enough to take the throne soon." She doesn't miss his implication. He doesn't miss the pain that rakes its invisible claws over her beautiful face. Amalasuintha sinks into a chair of carved, dark wood. A Roman chair. "Theodahad, if they had only let me have the raising of him! He was such a marvelous child, as sharp and bright as a pin, but my father's old counselors were so suspicious of his Roman tutors. They said I was making him unmanly, Theodahad." "They are barbarians." "They are Goths," Amalasuintha says, in a tone that is not quite an excuse, not quite a rebuke. "They're old fools, just as your father was. So suspicious of everything Roman that they'll starve rather than eat Roman food." "My father," she stops, remembering how Boethus died. The most brilliant man in the kingdom, left to die in a prison because her father mistrusted Roman learning, Roman art, Roman politics. She has no one she can trust, but she can't afford to make enemies. She is not her father. Amalasuintha takes a deep breath and starts again. "Theodahad, we have to be careful. Now more than ever, I am asking you for the good of the family." "Why now more than ever?" he asks, keeping his voice even, although he knows. He knows. Theodahad thinks of the silver armband he gave the boy king when the Goths took him to train him in the ways of war. "Now you are a warrior," he said, and watched the child slip it onto his arm. "Look. See how it bends. It will grow with the strength of your arm." The boy never takes it off except to clean it. Theodahad's spies tell him so. "They said he needed to be manly to rule," she says, half to herself. "They sent him off with a gang of rotten thugs to be his friends, to learn how to kill, to boast of their prowess in the brothels. I don't know what disease it was or where he got it, but he's ill, Theodahad." He can barely stop the corners of his mouth from dancing in triumph. The boy king is indeed sick, indeed dying. The silversmith did his work well. "He will recover," she says. "Of course," he agrees. But he knows better. "But my boy is ill," Amalasuintha says, pain and fear clouding her perception at that crucial moment. "And I am beset on all sides. My Roman subjects don't trust the Goths, and my Gothic subjects don't trust the Romans. How can I rule a kingdom so divided? How can I rule it if if I am queen alone? There. Do you see it? The moment of my conception. I germinate in Theodahad's brain. He watches the ripple of purple silk against Amalasuintha's breast, the contrast to the silver eagle on her shoulder. It reminds him of something. A book he has seen in Rome. A book with silver writing. I am sorry to hear that the young king has been ill, he says, having composed his rebellious smile. And I am sorry that I have added to your burdens. Let me make you a present to show my contrition. She waves him off. It will be a present of some use to you, I think, he says, talking quickly as schemes flow through the maze of his brain like quicksilver. The Goths are worried that their children don't speak their mother tongue in the streets, that the Romans mock them as barbarians, yes? And the Romans are disdainful of the Goths, and of your authority as a Gothic queen. She nods, respecting his directness, but not sure of his direction. Imagine a book of the Gospels, to display in your palace church. A book with pages in imperial purple. I've seen it done, but with one key distinction. This book will be in the Gothic language. Her eyebrows dance. Ulfila's translation of the Bible, then? He nods. A book to bring two peoples together. I know two scribes at the cathedral in Ravenna. Our people. They speak our language. But they can write books as the Romans do. Let me take care of it. She does not trust Theodahad, but there can be no harm in a book. And she can see how right he is, a book in imperial purple, in the Latin style, written in Gothic. A book to represent a Romano-Gothic empire and its queen. Her chin dips with sharp approval. He holds up his fettered wrists expectantly. The letter where is called where, which bears the number 700 and the meaning cauldron. Theodahad pays a visit to Dag the silversmith to thank him for the armband. It is working, he says, slowly, but it is working. You truly are a wizard. The smith wrings his hands. I am a smith, that's all. I know the properties of silver, and I bend them as little. Please, your grace, I'm just a smith. I have another commission for you, Theodahad says, pacing around the little charcoal forge, stooping so he doesn't hit his head on the beams. A gift for Amalasuintha. What do you know about silver? What do you know about how it excites, the smoothness of its touch, how it collects the moonlight? You know, perhaps, that old stories tell of it killing those who cannot be killed any other way. You know, perhaps, that it can save, preserve, enshrine. Silver wards. The other metals do other things, and other smiths have sinned. But we are not concerned with them here. Dag shakes his head. I will not kill the queen. Please don't ask me that. There must be some other way. Kill the queen? No, I wouldn't dream of it. And that, as far as it goes, and for the moment, is the truth. Theodahad has few friends among the Goths or the Romans. If Amalasuintha were to die, he would have a hard fight on his hands to take the throne from other, stronger claimants. But if Amalasuintha were to hand the throne over to him, as her father's new heir, well, that would be different. I'm not asking you to kill her. No armband this time. I'm simply informing you that a monk will come soon, asking for silver filings and leavings. They'll be making ink with it, you see, and I want the silver they use to have a certain effect on the queen's mind. Dag grips the bellows, trying very hard not to think of the little boy who was in one of Theodahad's many dungeons, and sick with guilt for trying not to think of him. "I've told you, I can't ensorcel anyone. I can only work with the ancient properties of silver, to heal and to kill." Theodahad spreads his arms wide. "And that is what I ask. I ask you to heal the queen's heart when it comes to her cousin. And I ask you to kill her ambition." Dag hangs his head. "It's impossible." "Then you will never see your son again." What is time to a book? An early page or late, it is all the same to me. Flip the pages forward through one millennium and one century, during which time I am hardly noticed. I go from monastery to abbey across Europe. I am not missing in these years. I am lying in wait. Pause there, in the year 1649. Find the letter Giva. The letter my scribes call Giva bears the number 3 and the meaning gift. Queen Christina has ruled Sweden since she was a child. They sent her father the king home in installments. First his bloody shirt, then his heart, then his body. He died in the same long war Christina is about to conclude. One of Christina's many titles is Queen of the Goths, although that notion's half fantasy. Christina stands in a great hall in Stockholm and watches as the plunder rolls through her doors, the fabled riches of the Emperor Rudolf. She sent her armies to Rudolf's castle in Prague with instructions to get it all to Sweden before the last signatures dried on the peace treaty. She will make Sweden the envy of the world. A bit of a yawn, though, all these crates and cartloads. There are 500 paintings. She will need someone to catalog them all. A jawbone purported to have been that of a siren. Sculptures and bronzes, enough scientific instruments to tame the universe. And the last, one solitary lion pacing the center line of the hall, leashed to a nervous-looking man on each side. At that, everyone stands and applauds because Christina already is. As the cheers soften and the lion is marched away, the man who led her armies in Prague appears in the doorway. Carl Gustav, her aunt's son and her childhood fencing partner, 26 years old and more handsome than he was when he left, although you'd think that impossible. Warfare agrees with him. He bows low, and she smiles. "Cousin," she greets him, "you have done well. But where are the books? You didn't forget Rudolf's famous library, surely?" He shakes his head. "I saved the best for last." Her breath catches a little, despite herself. It's a reflex. Everything with Carl Gustav is a reflex. When she was 15, 7 years ago now, Christina and Carl Gustav acted as if they were in love with each other, and she let herself get caught up in the notes and the secret meetings. It was all so exciting, but it didn't mean love. Not to her. Her cousin, though, is looking at her more fiercely than the lion did. He spoke those same words to her once before. "I saved the best for last." As the prelude to their first kiss, very nearly their last kiss. He has made the memory of that kiss his nightly prayer. All these years in sodden tents so far from her, everyone knows they're going to marry. She holds out her hand, and he leads her to an anteroom, where two great books are laid out on the tables, just as he arranged. They are, at last, alone. "This one they call the Devil's Bible," he says, opening a massive volume but gingerly. It is old. Near the back, she cries out with surprise, fear, delight. There's a full-page illustration of a devil with horns curving out of its head. It squats, with knobbed knees and splayed toes. She can't quite decide whether it's horrific or comical.
And that one?
She asks, pointing. He lifts the pages. They're dyed a reddish purple, and the lettering is in silver, with here and there a flash of gold. The Silver Bible, he says, or the Codex Argenteus, 1,000 years old or more.
What a strange alphabet, she says,
walking over to it and standing beside him.
I can't read it.
It's written in the Gothic language, he says. Few people can.
Well, I'll have to get some scholars here to decipher it. I can get anybody I want. I'm sending for René Descartes, you know.
She reaches out to touch the silver letters, and he reaches for her hand. So familiar, these two hands together. The war is over at last, he says, his voice thick.
I did what you asked of me. Everything you asked. And now I'm home. We can marry now, Christina.
She pulls her hand away.
I've decided I'm not going to marry anyone. I'm very happy ruling on my own.
He looks her in the eye.
You know that's not what it's about for me. I'm not interested in ruling.
You should be. You are the only remaining heir to the throne in our family. If I go to feed the worms, you're it, I'm sorry to tell you.
He shakes his head.
Don't. Don't laugh at me.
I'm not.
She puts one hand on each of his shoulders, comradely.
I mean it. I don't have any need to marry. I can't stand the idea of letting a man use me like a peasant uses his field. The only reason they want me to marry is so that there will be an heir. But you can be my heir. You and your children once you marry some lovely countess. You see, it all works out perfectly.
As if she's been listening outside the door and come to help. And maybe she has. Belle chooses that moment to walk in, dressed in blue velvet with a white lace collar. Beautiful Belle, the lady-in-waiting who now shares Christina's bed every night.
My darling, Christina says,
and decides to make everything clear to Carl Gustav. He must understand that for her to be queen and alive and happy, and herself, all at the same time, she must stand with her hands on her hips and stare the universe down. She can't let her gaze fall or her attitude soften, not for a moment, or it will all crash down around her. She kisses Belle on the mouth and entwines her arm in her own.
She is as beautiful on the inside as she is on the outside, Christina says,
winking at Carl Gustav.
Do you know what she tastes like?
No, of course you don't, but I do.
Sour cherries. It's remarkable.
Carl Gustav has been taken by surprise, but he is a man of quick intelligence, and he is nothing if not gallant. He nods and bows to Belle.
It is a pleasure to see you again.
Christina loves him too, albeit fraternally. She smiles at him to show how grateful she is for him, how truly grateful she is for the treasures he brought home to her. All three lean their heads over the table and pretend to examine the book with pages the color of scandal.
Otal is the name of the letter Otal, which holds the value 800 and means inheritance. There are many things Theodahad considers his own by right. A little island in Lake Bolsena is one of them, but we have not reached that page yet. The kingdom of the Ostrogoths is another. The day after the funeral rites for the young king, Amalasuintha calls her son's murderer into her private balcony to offer him a crown. She doesn't know, will never know, that he murdered her son. She knows only that he gave her a book some months ago in the language of their fathers. "They have destroyed my precious boy," she says, facing away from him, gazing out over her perfect gardens. These gardens were a mess when she took them over, and look at them now. "Yes, it is a terrible tragedy." She turns to look at him, her mouth a grim line. "I hear whispers that they won't accept a queen who rules alone with no king at her side. But I won't marry and let the throne fall out of our family's control." He nods, slowly, as if he doesn't know what's coming. The silver ink has done its work. "You are family, Theodahad, and lately I have been thinking that it is irresponsible of me to simply hope the Goths and Romans will accept you as king once I die. You know as well as I do what sort of machinations come when a sovereign dies." She refrains from saying, "And you know how much they hate you." "I do. It could tear our kingdom apart and destroy everything your father built." This is the moment, he thinks. The moment when she will make him king, and she'll go off to some nunnery and he'll never have to look at her again. This is the moment, he thinks, but can hardly bear to say the words. Still, if she doesn't, the whispers won't stop. She hears them even in the night when she's all alone, as if there are voices on the air, doubting her ability, warning of doom. "That is why," she says, and all the breath leaves her. She starts again. "That is why I am raising you up to be co-sovereign with me, Theodahad. I will continue to rule as I always have, but you will be at my side at ceremonial functions, and the people will come to accept you. The kingdom will have its king." She sees his look of surprise, misinterprets it. He accepts, after composing his face. They make the announcement, and Theodahad is crowned. 3 days later, Amalasuintha wakes to find a rough hand over her mouth and rough arms tying her wrists and ankles. Lagos means Lagos, which carries the number 30 and the meaning open water. Between Rome and Florence sits a round lake called Lake Bolsena. On a rocky island in that lake, Amalasuintha looks out through the bars of her window. She sees only the shapes of trees, hears only the lap of the waves. She is thinking about how easily a jackass with a few thugs at his command can bring down a nation. Somehow, Theoda had bribed or killed enough guards to abduct her and bring her here. Not all the money in the world, though, could make the Goths trust him, and the Romans despise him. How could he ruin everything, even for himself? She was going to rehabilitate him in their eyes, so that his children could rule. He was supposed to buy her time to create a succession, to save her father's kingdom. Instead, he's created a pretext for their rivals to invade. All that she's worked for, all her father fought for. She curls her hands around the cold iron bars, rough with rust. The kingdom's best hope now is for someone to assassinate Theodahad and break her out of this godforsaken island. It is bound to happen. The only question is whether it will happen in time to save the kingdom from invasion. The sun is low over the far shore, and soon she'll be in darkness. Her guards, Theodahad's silent giants, don't let her have lamp or candle, or even a change of clothes. But when the rescue comes, she will be ready. She will be a queen. She refuses to let them find her dirty or afraid. There is a cold plunge pool in the adjoining room where she can bathe. She takes a few steps on the cold stones, strips naked and eases herself in. The water seems almost as blue as the lake, an effect of the blue and green mosaic floor. In a kinder time, when these rooms were for guests rather than prisoners, this bath was heated, They could heat it now for her, if they wanted. Theodahad is taking a great risk treating her this way. She doesn't fathom that Theodahad doesn't think more than a few days ahead. He has no strategy. That's why he'll fail. But until he does, that's why he's dangerous. His thugs enter the room while Amalasuintha's head is underwater, her eyes shut and her hearing dampened. A hand grabs her by her dark, wet hair and pulls her to the edge of the pool. Her eyes are open and she struggles as a knife cuts her throat. The last thing she sees is her own blood swirling into the darkening water. Winya might mean a meadow, or it might mean joy, or it might mean the possibility that vibrates in a person standing alone in a meadow, arms spread. It definitely means 400. There are a few more than 400 men gathered in the great hall of the castle in Uppsala. Queen Christina sits before them, all these men in their stations. There are nobles and clergymen and burghers and peasants. A representative of each steps forward, bows low, and begs her not to abdicate. She does not meet Carl Gustav's gaze. 2 years ago, she formally designated him as her heir. Tomorrow, he'll be king. He isn't happy about it. He wonders, as he has wondered for months now, who has been whispering in her ear? Who convinced her that she could not be both happy and queen? Who suggested that she formally name her cousin as her heir? Who suggested that she then give the cousin her crown while she is still alive? It is utterly bizarre. Yet she insists it was all her own idea. And he has to admit that Christina has always had her own ideas about everything. As the last peasant brushes away his tears, the queen stands, resplendent in yellow brocade, and everyone else quiets. They all protest to love her, but they don't love her newfound Catholic faith, or her refusal to marry a man. They don't want her. They want her to be what they want. A few months ago, some of the most powerful men in the kingdom conspired against her. They talked of killing her before they were found and tried and executed. It was just talk, but one day, it won't be. "I thank you all for your eloquence and sincerity," she says. "My mind is made up, and nothing can change me from this course. I am leaving Sweden as soon as I can." She will always be a queen. But she will be a queen on ground that she has chosen. She will go to Rome and talk with artists and philosophers and live. After Carl Gustav's coronation by the grace of God and Christina, she has changed the spelling of her name, the queen without a country rises early and dresses in black trousers and boots. She cuts her hair short and buckles a sword at her hip. Her cousin finds her at her bedroom door, stops her. "Another farewell?" she asks. He swallows. "You never wanted to marry me before. You didn't want to lose your power, I understand. But now you've given all your power up." "My dear cousin, you think I've given up my power? I'll be far more powerful now than I ever was. The Jesuits adore me. The Pope lauds me. I'm still queen. I'm still fabulously wealthy. And now I can do whatever I want. I can shape the art and philosophy of a generation." He shakes his head, laughing a little. "You're really happy, then?" "Ecstatic. Now get out of my way." He will, but not for one more moment. He goes down on one knee, while she looks past him, half wondering if she might be able to vault over him. She's only 27 years old, and vaulting and running are still in her repertoire. "I don't care if you travel the world," he is saying. "I don't care if you worship as you see fit. Just come home to me once in a while. Come home to me, as my wife." She throws her head back and laughs.
How can you be so clever and so dim?
He shakes his head, rueful, then smiles a crooked smile.
I had to try. One last time.
She embraces him, wraps her arms around him, pats him on the back.
I'm going to be happy, my friend. I'm going to see everything. Italy, sunshine. I'll be the talk of Europe, you know. I'll send you back something pretty.
Manna is the letter that holds the number 40, and it is manna. Once upon a time, the words for both man and human were the same. Once upon a time, the word for woman was the same as the word for queen, and they were both quains.
As for me, I am unbound, pinioned under glass like a dead moth. I belong to the people now. My words remain, written on pages the color of empire. Don't you hear these whispers in a thousand tongues of silver, telling you you'll never be enough on your own? All you queens, paying me no heed.
And welcome back. Both Amala Suintha and Christina were real queens, and they both owned a book with purple pages called the Codex Argenteus, or in English, the Silver Bible. If you'd like to know more, please check out the interview that the author did for Lackingtons, which will also be linked in the show notes. As for me, I tend not to do quotes at the end of episodes because of what's lost by decontextualizing them. However, the following lyrics by Bay Area cellist Unwoman seeped through. I quote, I am all raccoon eyes, I am peacock-colored flesh. I am supple parchment, my skin a palimpsest. In red filigree the madmen carve their illustrious names, and with clumsy blue marks in quick succession stake their claims. No, no, nobody can own me. This is my only authority. My body is mine to poison. It is my gift for the killers to cut open. And that was our show for this week. On behalf of everyone here at Podcastle, our audio engineer, Peter Baravesh, our forum moderator, Aussie Cat, your co-editors, Jen Albert and Sheree Clark, along with all of our fantastic first readers, Matt Dovey, Aidan Doyle, Ebony Dunbar, Amalia Harrington, Kai Hudson, Devin Martin, Catherine McMahon, Ace Ratcliffe, Julian Jarbo, Craig Jackson, Julia Pat, Hamilton Perez, and Eleanor Wood. Thanks for letting us share another story with you. Podcastle is part of Escape Artists Incorporated and is distributed under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. Feel free to share our episodes, but don't sell or change them. If you like what you heard, head over to patreon.com/EAPodcasts and subscribe. Special shout out to Bizet, whose sunset photos are second to none, and whose debut novel, The Many Sniffs of August, is forthcoming in June 2021. We'll be back next week with another tale. See you then.